the U.S. became more diverse and is increasingly living in metro areas. Two key takeaways from the U.S. Census Bureau data. We learn what it tells us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The once-in-a-decade release is the result of those forms that tens of millions of people filled out last year. What stands out to you about the census numbers? Have you explored Wisconsin figures? Did you participate in the 2020 census or work on the census? Join in 800-642-1234. Stephen Ruggles is Regents Professor of History and Population Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Good morning. We also have Andy Beveridge with us, co-founder and president of Social Explorer. It's a demographic data mapping firm. He's a professor emeritus of sociology at Queens College in the Graduate School and University Center of the City University of New York. Andy, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
Well, Andy, you first, mapping being your life work, what stands out to you?
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, first off, I did look at Wisconsin. I mean, we actually worked yesterday to try to get the material for the Times' package, and it was very, very intense. This is the first time they've released all of the census all at once, and it's been quite a struggle to kind of get it tamed. I think one of the big things in Wisconsin, in the between 00 and 10, was Milwaukee grew, and it was probably one of the few Rust Belt cities that grew, across the Midwest or the upper Midwest, well, across the sort of the Rust Belt. This time, it's lost population. So, I mean, that's one of the big things. And then the second thing that I think you highlighted, and I think everybody's highlighting, is that the U.S. really has shifted away from being it's become much more diverse. We look particularly at the decline or growth of the non-Hispanic white population, and it basically declined most places. And then finally, I think we are seeing, as you're saying, an increase in the metro population, but also in some places, so apparently not in Milwaukee, to some extent in Madison, there's been an increase in the population in cities. For example, New York grew over 600,000.
Hmm. Well, I want to get
those kind of cities, which are coastal.
Yeah. I want to get back to Wisconsin numbers in just a moment here. But, Stephen, your top line takeaways from the new census data, what did you see?
Well, I think Andy's right that the increase in diversity would be the main empirical finding. But I do think that that's tempered by the fact that the white population is declining only if one defines white by the one drop rule, the racist interpretation of race that predominated the 19th century. If you have a broader view of any white, the white population is booming. It's just that more and more people are responding with mixed race responses. Also there's a large number of people who are recorded as some other race who are really, generally speaking, Hispanic, and probably most of them would have been in prior censuses recorded as white. So it's not as quite partly it's a matter of definition.
Yeah, Stephen, I wonder, what do you make of that rise in multiracial Americans and the fluidity of racial categories?
Yeah, well, my colleague Carolyn Liebler at the University of Minnesota has done a number of studies about the fluidity of racial responses. And she's shown that people from one survey to the next will shift their racial identification. So sometimes they'll respond as white only, sometimes they'll respond as mixed race. There's a huge amount of movement. Even when people are responding just a month apart, they'll change the way they report themselves. So it's not absolutely clear what to make of it. But there is a real increase in diversity in the sense of, or in mixed race. It's a reality in that people are getting, are more and more likely to intermarry across all racial groups. Then they have kids and the kids identify as multiracial.
Andy, the largest and most steady gains were among Hispanics, who doubled their population share over the past several decades. And nearly one in four Americans now identifies as either Hispanic or Asian. What do you make of these numbers?
Well, I think Steve's right about the race categories, because what happened, in the 2000 census, they finally allowed people to say there were more than one race. Up through 2000 in 1920 they had some of it, but I mean, they had, he's also right about the one drop rule, and there's very, if you go back and look at historical census documents, and they tell the enumerator what they're supposed to do if they find somebody who's multi-race. In fact, in the 1890 census, you're supposed to mark for African, for black, people who are blacks, whether they were black, mulatto, quadroon, or octoroon. I mean, and they defined it in terms of blood. So race has been a category that really was biological, and it sort of morphed into a social category, and it's become a category of what you say, you report it. And so something like Hispanic, I mean, for example, 95% of Mexicans who report that they're Hispanic report that also with Hispanic is separate from the race category in the census questionnaire, 95% of them report that they're white. So taking the Hispanic category, it's not, it's not clear just from that category whether or not, if you count the white Hispanics in, it changes the calculation quite a lot. And then in terms of things like Asian, there are multiple Asian groups. And there are multiple, and is Asian really a race? That's how it's defined. And it's really, it's a self-report. And so there was an attempt, and in fact, the Census Bureau spent about 8 years of research trying to combine ethnicity with race, and they were going to add a new ethnic category called Mideastern and North African. And it was nixed by the Trump administration. And then the second thing that happened with this administration is that if you were white or black, which is they asked you what subcategory you were in. And so it used to be that if you were white or black, that was the end of the query if you reported those two races. Now they ask subcategories, but they've always had that for Asian, for Native, for American Indian and Aleutian Islander, for Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. And then with Hispanic, they've always asked what Hispanic origin are you? Mm-hmm. So really, it's become an origin question, but it still hangs on to this notion it's race, and still hangs on to the notion that it's biological. And so in terms of both the Asians, the Asian community and the Latino community, the bulk of both are, from immigrants, are immigrant. I mean, are either children of immigrants or immigrants. Now, it is true that there were Chinese here, late part of the 19th century. It's also true that the Puerto Ricans, who are from Puerto Rico, are not exactly considered immigrants when they moved to the United States, are citizens. But, this really shows not just kind of a racial shift, but it also shows a shift, but it's a long-term, long-term history of the U.S. being populated by people from other countries. And it really was triggered by a change in there was huge restrictions put in the 20s on immigration. And it was opened up in 65 and then further in 82. And that's really what's driving this. And, of course, the last administration wanted to stop that.
We're going to pause right there with sociologist Andy Beveridge, who leads the demographic data mapping tools firm. Stephen Ruggles with us, history and population studies professor at the University of Minnesota. The data from the 2020 census was closely watched. What do you think it will mean for redistricting? What questions do you have about the statistics and what they say about Wisconsin? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Census Bureau says more detailed redistricting specific information will be released by late September. We're talking about census data takeaways with your questions and insights on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. States are responsible for legislative redistricting. The Census Bureau provides the population counts for the work of redrawing political boundaries. We learned almost all of the population growth was in metro areas. What does this mean for the rural-urban divide in American politics? Join in with your perspective on the census data, 800-642-1234. We have University of Minnesota History and Population Studies Professor Stephen Ruggles and Queens College Emeritus Sociology Professor Andy Beveridge. They stay with us. Joining us now, let's go to Owen in Wyawega. Owen, what are your thoughts on the census?
Good morning, Kate, and thank you, Andy, and the other guest. I live in the rural area here in Wisconsin, and so I'm trying to figure out how we can quantify the amount of labor here in our rural areas that are predominantly Republican districts that do not properly represent the labor that is working and performing most of the work on these dairy farms and larger agricultural endeavors, because they're foreign-born and foreign citizens who live here permanently as residents of this country for many, many years consecutively, but have never gotten any citizenship, so they're unable to participate in democracy. So it doesn't properly or adequately represent the districts because of the disenfranchisement of most of the labor here in our rural areas. So I believe Republicans have found a way to gerrymander a very grotesque and twisted reality of what our rural population's actual voting capacity would be.
Owen, thanks. Stephen Ruggles, you first.
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. If they can't get a citizenship, they can't vote, but they still get counted in the census and they count towards representatives. The larger trends, the increasing diversity, the decline of rural areas and the growth of cities, generally is good news for Democrats. But on the other hand, the shift of population to the Sun Belt, where the districting is largely controlled by Republicans, is good news for them.
Andy, the release of the census data, that begins the contentious redistricting battles. How will insights from the census be used to draw political boundaries?
Well, actually, I do redistricting, some on contract and also some under court, court challenges to get in. And I would say that this census is going to trigger, along with the voting, the various rule laws that have been, I think there's something like 168 laws have been proposed, various states, to some of which deal with redistricting. Wisconsin, is the poster child for a case on gerrymandering that, in fact, led to a ruling that, ultimately led to a ruling that you couldn't do anything. There was no way for the court to get involved with a political gerrymander. So there's massive gerrymandering. It's been going on forever, but it was really given, supercharged by the advent of computerized mapping, and the Republicans jumped in there first and spent millions of dollars during the round that really got going with that led to 2012, and drew all sorts of districts that are really truly biased in both in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. The state court struck down the plan, and in, I believe in Pennsylvania, it led to three or four more. They have 13 seats. Mm-hmm. It led to three or four more Democratic seats, similarly in North Carolina. So there is, so the gerrymandering, you can do a lot with gerrymandering. And then the second thing you should know is that they, in terms of the rural population at the, I don't know the name of the town that he was talking about, but there was an attempt by the Republicans to take out of the count for redistricting non-citizens and children. And that, which was the Evanwell case, it didn't happen in Evanwell, but the court left the door open for states trying that, and Missouri's going to try that. So I think we're going to see the most contentious round of redistricting we've ever seen. Hmm. The Democrats are more organized than normal. And then on topping that all off, the census has made the data. They put in this thing called differential privacy, so they put noise into the data. So at the block level, which you actually use for redistricting, it's going to, you know, there's going to be more difficulty drawing. So,
and I want to just pause there as to reintroduce you for a moment, Andy Beveridge, co-founder and president of Social Explorer. Stephen Ruggles with us, Regents Professor of History and Population Studies at the University of Minnesota, directs the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation. Let's go to Tom now in Madison. Tom, what are your thoughts on the census?
Good morning. I just wanted to follow up on the idea of redistricting using strict geographical features and strict county boundaries. And if necessary, you simply draw a line across the bottom, you know, fifth of the state. We have eight seats, you know, you just have eight lines border to border. And that means that every representative will have urban, rural, and suburban voters in their district, and we won't be gerrymandering by neighborhood. And, you know, it'll just be your district is a straight line across the state.
Tom, thanks.
Vertical or horizontal.
Yeah, Tom, thank you. Stephen, can it be that clear cut? Can it be that clean?
Well, I'm not the expert on redistricting, but I think that would be difficult to get equal population sizes. But certainly you can make districts that are not anywhere near as biased as the ones that we have. I think that the 2020 round of redistricting is going to be even bigger than 2010 was, partly because of the Supreme Court, which has said, well, on the one hand, that partisan redistricting is okay, or at least they're not going to block it, and also they have limited the Voting Rights Act to the point where people are going to feel less constrained than they were in 2010.
Andy, I want to circle back to Wisconsin for a moment. Wisconsin being, you know, an aging population, we've been watching this demographic shift for years. And in recent times, we've seen colleges and universities, they've started to adjust to having fewer college-age students to draw from for their population size. So is the census data reflecting this aging trend?
Well, it will, yes. I mean, the data that was just released, they only have two age categories, 18 or over or under.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so all you would know is you would know actually from that whether there was kind of a birth dearth, which also has kind of happened. And you're right. If you look at the demography going forward for colleges, it's not a, you know, in terms of demography going forward for even for K to 12, it's very clear that there's going to be a decline because people are not having babies like they used to have, 20, 30 years ago. Steve is actually a real expert on family demography, so he might be a better answer to this question.
Yeah, Stephen, your insights there on Wisconsin's aging population.
I don't know that I have much insight into it. It is what it is.
And I'm wondering too, how do you approach quality control and quality reviews on the census data, Stephen?
Well, I think we've got a real concern about data quality in 2020. One of the issues is what they call item non-response. And what that is where the census manages to count somebody, but they don't get a response for the specific questions like age, sex, race, family relationship, or Hispanic origin. There was a recent FOIA request in conjunction with a lawsuit that revealed that the non-response rate for all questions in the 2020 census was running between 10 and 20%, averaging about 15%.
Well, let's pause there for a news update. We'll get back to this on the Ideas Network. The 2020 census data was closely followed. It was delayed due to the pandemic. We're talking about what the numbers tell us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The first detailed results of the census indicate that the white population shrank for the first time in history and people continued to move out of rural areas. What stands out to you from the census data? What shifts do you feel in your community that are illustrated by these numbers? 800-642-1234. Andy Beveridge is CEO of Social Explorer and a professor emeritus of sociology at Queens College. And we have University of Minnesota Professor Stephen Ruggles, who leads the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation, and they're with us for the hour. Stephen, you were talking about that 10 to 20% of questions were not answered in the census, depending on the question and the state. How does that affect the validity of the census?
Well, it's about 10 times the non-response rate of any previous census, and that's a big concern. The director of the Census Bureau, the acting director, Ron Jarman, indicated that the error was similar across all the different response modes. The response modes are like internet, paper, whether people were interviewed directly or on the phone. And so that's a real puzzle as to how that could have happened. What we don't know yet is what the level of whole household imputation is. That is the cases where they were unable to get any information about the household at all, even the number of people from neighbors or whatever, and so that they simply had to impute a whole household. And so we don't know what level that is. That usually is just a percent or two, but it could be much higher this time as well. And now they're doing imputation for group quarters because apparently they were not able to get full information on the group quarters population either, which is nursing homes and college dormitories and the like.
You mentioned Acting Director Ron Jarman, who spoke about how the Census Bureau made an attempt to respond to privacy concerns.
I will say that, you know, one of the things when we were getting ready to do the census and we were doing research on what were the barriers and motivators for people to respond to the census, the confidentiality of their responses was very high up there.
So, Andy, I believe you mentioned differential privacy. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Yeah, differential privacy is it's basically a mathematical or computer science theorem. And what they do is they take a distribution and they basically inject a certain amount of noise into each and every count, and they have what they call a budget for the noise. The interesting thing about differential privacy, if you just run it, it actually would turn some of the counts negative. So in other words, you would have a situation where maybe a small town would turn out to have a negative population. So since that's so completely absurd, they decided to do what's called post-processing. So they processed it after the fact. So no town or any count as a negative. However, it appears that along with it, the thing itself has injected a certain amount of bias into differential privacy. And both Steve and I are not big fans of differential privacy. And there was a comment period when they put out a so-called, you know, example based on the 2010 census. And it looks like, going back to your redistricting thing, that it will make it much harder to draw majority-minority districts, which are what is done to protect minority rights. And there's a whole bunch of other issues. There may be, you know, some towns may get the wrong number. They won't actually know. There's the Harvard, a group of Harvard researchers did a study, and they likened differential privacy to a lottery. You know, either you may get the right number or you may not, just depending on luck. And then Steve has looked at it and very carefully, actually, whether or not it actually does protect privacy. And I think he would probably be very helpful to make a comment or two about that.
Yeah, Stephen, go ahead.
Well, I did an analysis of the Census Bureau's. The Census Bureau did a study, an experiment where they tried to reconstruct the population from 2010 using only the published tables. And they claimed that they re-identified 17% of the population and that this represented a terrible risk. And, we discovered that, in fact, this was like a clinical trial with no control group. They did their reconstruction was really no better than a roll of a dice. They guessed people's age, sex, race, and whether Hispanic, and they got it right about as many times as you would expect if they were just guessing. It is not possible, I believe, to infer people's characteristics from the published census, and all of this was unnecessary. And it just seems like a shame that they did such a sloppy job.
Well, can you explain the numbers released Thursday versus what is coming out September 30th on redistricting specific information? What more is coming out here? Andy?
Nothing. Okay. They're just going to be in a different format. What happened was that there was an Ohio case where they pressed for quicker release. And so to accommodate that, they put the data out in what's called the legacy format, what they call the legacy format, which is actually the same format they used in 2010. And quite honestly, everybody, all the redistricting software vendors and people like me who have, you know, I processed 2010 for the New York Times, we all had programs ready to go on the legacy format, and really raises a question, why they even bother coming up with a new format? But I guess they have a new data distribution system. So the next set of data, there is no, which will include much more detailed age, much more detailed sex and race, hopefully will include data that includes like number of kids below 18 in households and stuff like that. Will include data that it joins households and people. We don't know when those are going to come out. Normally it would be about 3 months from now, but there's been no date because implementing the differential privacy algorithm theorem with the table data that includes people and households has turned out to be impossible. And someone published, actually, part of it came from Steve's operation, but the Minnesota people. But they published a whole set of absurd blocks. For example, one group is there was something like 600,000 or 700,000 blocks out of, well, there were 11 million blocks in 2010. Now they're about 8 million, but there were about a 6 or 7 million blocks, 600,000 or 700,000 blocks out of the, well, out of the about 6 million that have people in them, or 10%. Were consisted only of children. Steve called him. What did you call him, Steve? You had a name for it.
The Lord of the Flies Blocks.
Lord of the Flies Blocks. Yeah. And there's a whole bunch of other crazy things. Like they put in Latinos where there were no Latinos, blacks where there were no blacks. They put people into blocks where there were no housing units or where there were no occupied housing units. They had occupied housing units where they had no people. So the differential privacy at the level of blocks is basically you're going to make it virtually impossible to use blocks for anything. Furthermore, if you take the blocks and you show them to a neighbor, because I've done this in the redistricting context, you often do maps. Mm-hmm. People are going to say, well, that's not my block. You know, so I don't know how they got into this differential privacy thing, but it seems to have gotten way out of hand. They used this method in 2010, which I think Steve probably understands better than I do, called swapping, where blocks that were in fact vulnerable to privacy issues were swapped. And they made sure that the block count stayed the same. This time, you won't even know for sure. They did not agree to keep the counts of a specific block the same. And there's big differences. I think Steve knows more about there's a Liberty Island case to sort of become the poster child case.
Well, I want to jump in here and reintroduce both of you as we talk with Andy Beveridge and Stephen Ruggles. They're both demographic experts. As we look at the census release, the data, what it means to you at 800-642-1234. We heard from Matt in Wausau, sent us an email, Stephen, and said between the Trump administration's open attempts to hamstring the census count, his intimidation of immigrants and the pandemic, what assurances do we have that the counts are correct?
Yeah, well, that is a real concern. I mean, especially given the little hints that we have about the unprecedented poor data quality. I did an analysis that was just a very simple analysis of the state differences in response, in item non-response rates. And, you know, I did find that the most important predictor at the state level of non-response was the percentage of Hispanics in the state. So it seems pretty likely that the attempt to put the citizenship question into the census last year and the other did you lead to concern about from Hispanics and you know Ron Jarman says people are worried about confidentiality. It turns out what they're really worried about is the government using the data against them, or the government somehow using them to track down undocumented immigrants and that sort of thing. Nobody's worried about somebody breaking into the statistical tables and somehow finding out that I'm black or I'm 42 years old or something like that. The census only has six questions, and most of them are things that are commonly known. Hmm. Their age, sex, race, whether or not Hispanic, and whether a property is owned or rented.
Well, I want to ask another question flowing in here. Richard in West Allis called, couldn't stay, but wants to know how the census counts incarcerated people. Are they counted where they are imprisoned or where they are originally from? What does that mean for their districts, Richard says, if they're unable to vote, especially in rural areas with prisons? Andy, can you field that?
Yeah, I've been involved with what's called the Prison Policy Initiative, which has made that a number one priority. There are districts, what they do, they count them, the Census Bureau counts them at the prison, but there's a number of states, including California, New York, Colorado, possibly Montana, that are now trying to relocate the prisoners back to their communities. And the Census Bureau has been very kind of like recalcitrant about doing this. And, you know, there are a couple million people in prison. And so those people are actually given to the rural area if the prisons are in the rural area. I mean, this happened in New York. I mean, all of the prisons are in rural areas of New York, or all of the state ones, and they used it to carefully craft legislative districts. They put it in, 3,000-person prison, and it would mean that district was actually light anyway. And so they are disenfranchised generally, though you can get the franchise back in some states, but they do not allow, they count them at the prison. And the interesting thing is, legally, prisoners are not considered residents of the prison. They're considered they're considered what's called involuntary sojourners. In other words, they're there, but they're not. See, residency requires domicile plus intent to remain. And they don't intend to remain if they're let go. And so it wasn't a big deal when the U.S. didn't have mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. But since mass incarceration grew, it's declining somewhat now. But when it grew, it became a big issue. And it's had, the politicians will do anything to gerrymander. I mean, I've sat in the meetings where they do it. So I'm willing to testify to that. And they'll do anything to keep in office. So they use the prisons like little things that they can move around to enhance their ability to win a district.
Andy Beveridge leads the demographic mapping firm Social Explorer. Stephen Ruggles, a historian and population studies professor at the University of Minnesota. The nation's population grew by just 7.4% during the decade. What do you think of the slowing growth? What do you want to know about the census's history, its purpose, its politics, its validity today? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the new data from the 2020 census, how it affects our lives, with a pair of demographic researchers in Minnesota and New York. The census data showed that our country's population growth was driven by metro areas and minority groups. This data will have massive implications on the redistricting process, as states like Wisconsin have been waiting on this data to redraw political boundaries. Stephen Ruggles is Regents Professor of History and Population Studies at the University of Minnesota. And sociologist Andy Beveridge is here, CEO of Social Explorer. They're with us for about 8 more minutes. Stephen, the Census Bureau says the U.S. population growth slowed to the lowest rate since the Great Depression. What insight can you give us on the slowing?
Well, we've been going through a massive demographic shift. The fertility is declining. Marriage is declining. Young people are not getting married, but they're not only not getting married, a lot of them are not getting partnered at all. And so fewer of them are having children. There is the childbearing is becoming separate from marriage. A lot of kids are born to single parents, but there's just an awful lot of parents that living by themselves or with their parents. Young adults residing with their parents has become a much more common thing lately. At any rate, fertility is plummeting, and that I think, and of course mortality, which is the other determinant of natural increase, mortality has been stagnant, has stopped dropping as rapidly as it had. So the combination of declining fertility and stagnant mortality means you're going to have slower growth. Without immigration, it would be even slower.
Andy, how has the rate of population growth changed within the Midwest, specifically over time, over the decade?
Well, I think parts of the Midwest, if you go a little bit west of Wisconsin into Nebraska, et cetera, and there's some parts also in the east that have experienced the same thing. I mean, the shift from metropolitan you know, to metropolitan from a rural area, from a non, you know, non-metropolitan areas has been going on for quite a long time. I remember one time we did an analysis of the brain drain from Nebraska. And so that's also a very, you know, very serious issue, because what you have is you have people, you know, younger people, particularly the better educated people, they have a tendency to want to settle in metropolitan areas, partially because there's many more job prospects in metropolitan areas than there are, you know, in a smaller city or rural community. And this is picked up also with respect to women and men. I mean, women have many more opportunities in metropolitan areas. So there really is more and more, I think, of a divide like that. I mean, New York State, for example, the upstate New York is in decline. Mm. I'm sure that that's probably true in, you know, I didn't look at it yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to find that in northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, you know, all of the areas like that. I mean, part of it had to do with the the massive technological change in agriculture, and the fact that agriculture shifted to, you know, big farms, you know, K-Foss, like big ag.
Well, you know, at the outset of the conversation, you had started to talk a little bit more about Milwaukee and Madison. What did you see there?
Well, I mean, that's probably an interesting comparison, because Madison is kind of it's probably based on information and those sorts of jobs, you know, high caliber service jobs. Milwaukee, which did buck the trend between 2000 and 2010 in terms of growth, you know, declined about, I think it's about roughly about 3%. And Milwaukee, you know, is a heavy, you know, traditionally was a heavy industrial town like Kenosha, like Racine. And, you know, those sorts of jobs are gone. Mm. You know, that's what's happened. That kind of industrial structure is gone. And so if you don't find something to replace it, you know, then you often face decline, because at some level, you know, the economic opportunities are going to go lead to growth or decline. You know, it's like North Dakota. North Dakota had this oil boom and they had a huge increase, and now that's sort of petered out, so the, you know, decline takes over. So, but I think in terms of the overall economy, I mean, our economy has shifted way away from industrial. An awful lot of stuff's been outsourced and sent overseas. So this is what you see. I mean,
I want to give Stephen Ruggles here just the last word. We only have a couple of seconds left. Yeah. Stephen, is the 2020 census going to be less accurate compared with previous ones?
I think inevitably. The only question is how bad it'll be. But there's no question that all the signs are that. And it's not a surprise. Mm. I mean, we had a pandemic, but there may be other factors as well.
Well, Stephen, Stephen and Andy, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it. Thanks. Thank you.
Sociologist Andy Beveridge, president of the demographic mapping firm Social Explorer, and Stephen Ruggles there, history and population studies, regents professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.